The views expressed on Science for the People are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
This week on Science for the People, we're learning about the limits of the human body and the essential science of survival. Hello and welcome to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. My guest today is Dr. James Hubbard, survival medicine expert. At his popular website, thesurvivaldoctor.com, he writes about how to deal with medical problems during a disaster or whenever expert help is impossible to get. Dr. Hubbard's evidence-based tips are a combination of modern medicine, makeshift treatments, and grandma's home remedies. He's the author of four books, including his latest, Duct Tape 911, The Many Amazing Medical Things That You Can Do to Tape Yourself Together, and Living Ready Pocket Manual, First Aid. Welcome, James.
Thank you for having me.
Now, survival medicine is a heck of a specialty. How did you get into that?
Well, it's just a combination of things. I've been a family practice doctor for many years now. Back in the 80s, when I started, you couldn't get 911 right away every time. A lot of people lived out and it took a while for them to get there. And so they learned how to live on their own. And I learned from them. I also learned and am still learning things from them, and also things that they might try that they're wrong about, that at least I think they're wrong about it. And so I try to put a little of that in my website on both sides. Things that you can do when you can't get to the doctor, and things you might not, that you might think are right, but maybe you're not so right.
Well, on your website, you are very careful to continually repeat throughout the posts that this blog is for when you can't get to a doctor. It's not either or, correct?
That is correct. This is just for information that I'm giving. I'm not trying to make other people doctors or treating themselves. I'm just trying to give them some information to go on with, to help them in their lives. And especially if they can't get help and something comes up and a medical problem and you just can't get to the doctor. And that, unfortunately, that can happen at any time. Even if you can, it may be a little bit of delay before 911 gets there, and that certainly happens every year.
So you point out that sometimes there is no other way to treat issues other than real medical assistance. So for those other cases, you've provided what, your best guess or things that might work? What kind of evidence is your case based on?
I try to base my evidence on studies if I possibly can, even with the grandma's remedies, like things like honey. They've been studied, and they help coughs, and raw honey is great for, an antibiotic for a wound or something, a topical. So I try to base it on studies. But then there are sometimes, and people hate to hear this, but it's just true that sometimes there's just things you can't do when you're not in the field, when you're out in the field and you don't have expert help. What I can't do. And at those times, I try to say, okay, you can hope and you can, do some support things, but mostly if there's any chance at all, try to get medical help. In some situations, medical help can be available. It just might be dangerous to get to or trouble. I mean, if you're in the middle of an ice storm, or in the middle of some chaos or something, it might be dangerous. And then you have to make the decision. Well, is it worth it? And I try to give you a little bit more to go on that. If you're on a hike or camping or somewhere way out, and it's a difference, in either having to stay there or try to get back and it's going to take several hours, or maybe find some way to get air help or something. I try to give you information on what to do.
Well, you cover such a range of topics, everything from how to disinfect water to how to treat stab wounds. So let's talk about some specifics that you do cover on the website. And I'm going to give you a scenario. I will set the stage. There's a massive storm. The news is reporting flooding everywhere. An old tree is struck by lightning and it crashes through your front window. On the way down, it takes out a power line and the lights go out. So while you're fumbling around in the dark, you cut your leg on glass, and it's a rather large cut. So what do you do?
Hey, that's a great scenario. I love scenarios. In fact, I use them for teaching all the time. Okay. First off, Well, what you do is you put pressure on the wound. That's one of the things you should have a reflex in your mind. If you see bleeding, put pressure on it, direct pressure. Thing about emergencies and situations like that is they come out of the blue and your mind goes in a panic mode and you stop thinking a little. It's kind of hard to think rationally or think about things for a few minutes sometimes. So it's good to have a reflex. Do things that can save your, that could be life-threatening within minutes and something you can do. And in this case, you'd put pressure on that wound until, and you've got it covered there for a little bit. And then you can, you know, take a breath and say, okay, what do I do next or whatever? If the pressure doesn't help, you can use a tourniquet. Tourniquets have a bad rap and a lot of it is true. But in a certain situations, if the bleeding won't stop and it's, and you hit an artery, a tourniquet can save your life.
What if instead of a cut being on your leg, you actually have a tree branch poking through it?
Now, a tree branch poking through your leg. Now that's pretty good.
I have seen this happen to somebody's arm in front of me.
Very disturbing. If I were to be able to get help within a certain amount of time, within, you know, a day or whatever, I'd leave that tree branch there. If there were a lot of bleeding, I would try a tourniquet above it or I would put pressure on it. I wouldn't remove the tree branch. If something is deep, especially in the abdomen or chest, but in this case in the arm, it could be, when you try to remove it, you're going to cause some damage by just trying to remove it. The second thing is it could be putting pressure on a source of a blood vessel that would otherwise be bleeding. I think that the best thing to do would be just to leave it alone if it's going to be, you know, even a few hours and you can tolerate it in some way, form or fashion, leave it alone and until you get to the doctor and let them take it out.
Now, not all of your posts are disaster-oriented. You have a section on snake bites that I found really interesting because your advice was sort of contrary to what we've been told in the movies.
The movies, yeah, they go for more drama and to keep you involved as opposed to sometimes being realistic. Certainly with a snake bite, you don't cut the wound. You don't try to suck out the venom. Both of those, neither one have been shown to help. And they're just going to make you more prone to having an infected wound. That's worse. Most snake bites, even the venomous snake bites, people live through them here in North America. People live through them. They can have a severe swelling sometimes. But, the only thing you can really do other than, you know, treat the wound, treat the swelling, elevate it, that sort of thing, treat the pain, is try to get medical help as soon as possible. Because if any venom is the only thing that might help, and it's only used in certain situations, but if it is used, it needs to be used soon. Otherwise, if you're out in the wilderness and you're not able to do that, you just clean that wound and just like you would any other wound and try to keep it from getting infected, you know, and then also keep it at about level of your heart so that the venom is not rushing too much to other parts of your body, but on the other hand, it's just there on compromise. So it's your arm or leg or whatever might be swelling more. So, keeping it right at heart level is probably about the best thing to do. One other thing you might try to do, and this may or may not help, is you could put a compression dressing on it. You can start, around the wound and just put it directly on it. It's not a tourniquet and don't put it tight enough to be a tourniquet, but just good in pressure. And some people have shown that that's helped. It's still up in the air whether it's going to show that how much it does, though.
Such practical advice. Now, of course, it is the season to talk about hypothermia. So what are the symptoms?
Oh, yeah. If you have hypothermia, one of the first symptoms can be confusion, surprisingly. So I would suggest that if you're going to go out in the cold, you and somebody else go together. And hopefully both of you don't get confused at the same time because you could, and one of you will notice and say, hey, we need to go inside. Nausea can be a subtle changes like that. Nausea, confusion can be the first signs. Always layer when you dress so that you don't sweat, because sweat can and liquids can take away heat from your body. But then, on the other hand, you want to stay warm. Always try to eat a little something before you go, because your body uses food for energy and fuel. And also make sure that you drink a lot of water and fluids. Whether you're getting too hot or too cold, it's really important to stay hydrated up, because if you're not, your body just doesn't fight off, just doesn't regulate your temperature as best you can. Don't rub. In a situation where it really might count, don't start rubbing your body or your arms. You make yourself feel warmer, but you're bringing your blood to the surface of where the heat can escape. And what your body should be doing and trying to do is keep as much blood as it can toward the core where your organs are, and keep those good and warm.
And sort of the same goes for alcohol then.
It does. It goes for alcohol. Same thing. Basically the same thing. Yeah. Alcohol makes you feel warm. It dilates those blood vessels close to your skin. But then on the other hand, it allows the heat to escape. So, and it may make you feel warmer, but it's cooling off your core, your heart, your brain, your kidneys, whatever, your liver. And that's what's really the most important to keep you alive.
And I think one of the things that you mentioned in that post that I found valuable was the reminder that it doesn't have to be freezing outside for you to become hypothermic.
And that's certainly true. People get hypothermic in 50 degree weather. If you get wet, heat escapes, conducts through water about 30 times better than it conducts through air. So if you get wet, that's the problem. If you get overtired or fatigued, or have health problems, those can also be problems and can make you more prone to get hypothermic even in the temperatures above freezing.
You say in one of your posts on the topic, and this will stick with me forever, no one is dead until they're warm and dead. Can you explain that?
That's one of those kind of semi-morbid things that emergency people say. And the thing is that if a lot of people have been revived once they've warmed up from – their body has warmed up from a cold. So in a situation where somebody is hypothermic, really hypothermic, and it's possible they could still have a weak heartbeat. And if you jostle them around, number one, this is a little off, but if you jostle them around too much, it can, the heart is real irritable when it's cold, and you could cause an irregular heartbeat that could be life threatening. But on the, back to the other, what you do is you, continue to resuscitate, continue to breathe for them. In some cases, you might do chest compressions, especially if they're in a drowning situation or something, and you try to get them back and to some facility where, when they get warm, people will have things on hand that could help, things like electroshock or something like that for the heart. And it's because when they warm back up, it's certainly possible that they may still be alive and may be in pretty good shape, their brain and everything. Certainly happened.
This is Science for the People, and I'm talking to Dr. James Hubbard, survival medicine expert and the man behind thesurvivaldoctor.com. Now, you also provide advice for conditions that probably aren't lethal. They're just painful or annoying. And that makes sense for your blog, because if there is a disaster and emergency rooms are too full or unable to treat you, they're probably too busy for your eczema.
That's true. And you know, things like that, eczema and skin problems that you would otherwise maybe not think about so much. You get a little crack in the skin or something, and it gets infected, and you don't have anything to treat it with. And all of a sudden, something that's usually fairly common can turn into something severe. So prevention is really key. And one of the preventive things is to try to keep that skin moist. Certainly you get out in the cold weather, damages the oils on your skin. So that they just don't work as well, and the oil is what partly prevents you from more skin damage. It also keeps the moisture in, and so you damage that oil, and your skin's going to dry out and crack, and you know, so keep it moist, keep it hopefully covered if it's really cold. But get, you know, whatever you want to use for oil type to help protect you, whether it's anything from your favorite moisturizer to some petroleum jelly or what, whatever you have on hand is the thing to use to do that, as opposed to letting it crack and dry and become infected.
Another good example is pinworms. What causes pinworms?
Pinworms come from person to person. Most of the time you'll see them with kids in school, and they're so, so contagious. They're little tiny little eggs. Sometimes they can even float in the air. They're so tiny. And they get under fingernails. They get in the bed and something. Somebody touches their face and ends up with a hand in the mouth or something. You touch your face no matter whether you think you do or not, multiple times per day. And you have the worms. And then the worms go through your system. They go into your intestinal system, come out the other end, but at some point, again, it's so easy to get them. Once one family member gets them or one close contact gets them, typically everybody's going to get them. They're uncommon, you know, can get on a toy or something like that. They're little tiny little worms. They are not that much of a danger. They can drive you crazy with the itching, rectal itching, which especially comes on at night. Rarely they can cause some abdominal problems, but usually they're more of a nuisance. And the thing, they're so hard to treat unless you treat everybody and treat the, you know, the clothes and everything that could be, have the pinworms in there.
And especially during a disaster situation, hygiene and washing isn't really at the foremost.
It isn't, and people are close together a lot of times.
So are people more at risk for things like this during a disaster situation?
Yeah, especially if there are crowds. Something like if you were to go to a disaster center, be sure to take you some alcohol wipes, some that the 60% alcohol or better. Be sure to take some things that will other things you can think of that might protect you. You might even want to take some disposable gloves. You might even want to take a mask and things like that because you're so close to everybody. So everything's going around. It can be hygiene. Definitely. But then on the other hand, the cleanest people in the world can get pinworms and other things if somebody, they just become exposed to it. Same with head lice, same with body lice, same with, body lice usually is more typical of close contact and not washing very much. And especially because the lice stay in the clothes actually and get off. And body lice are one of those things that can cause diseases. Pinworms and head lice. Nobody wants them, but they're not going to cause any life-threatening problems usually.
Now, I love the post on how to tell if you have a concussion. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, concussions have become much more in vogue these days. When I first started, people really didn't think that much about them. If you didn't get knocked out, you didn't worry. But as we come to find out, especially during sports and things, it is a worry. You don't have to get knocked out. Basically anything, you have head trauma and you have a symptom from it. You become nauseated for more than, a minute or two. You get a severe headache other than you're going to have a headache where you get hit probably, and that's different. But if it's a really, inside headache, you get dizzy, you lose memory, whatever, stuff like that, you do get knocked out. Any of those things. And we've come to find out that not only do you have to decrease your physical activities, but you have to decrease your mental activities too. Kind of hard to tell those kids not to, our adults these days too, I guess, not to be on those computers playing games or anything. You should rest your mind. And it's not like television where you get knocked out for 30 minutes, come up right and start going again full strength. Because if you were to have that, you'd probably have a really bad headache. You'd be dizzy. You'd have blurred vision. You'd have nausea. The thing about it is if you don't take that seriously and rest, it can linger for like days to even weeks and longer. Sometimes it'll do that anyway. But if you don't, it's much more likely to.
Well, what about the idea that you shouldn't let someone go to sleep if you think they might have a concussion?
That's a kind of a judgment call. I've seen so many times in my practice somebody, some kid or an adult get hit in the head, you know, have a cut or something like that. They're all excited. A lot of times crying, et cetera. And then I tell the parents, look, they're worn out. They're going to want to sleep. Everybody's got to sleep some. Let them sleep at the regular time. Wake them up. If they're not easily arousable as usual, then you get worried. Now, if it were a more severe head injury, I would say you're going to have to wake them up every few, regularly every 15 minutes, 30 minutes for a while, then space it out further and further. Check them, make sure, they're oriented. They know where they are. Make sure their pupils and everything are okay. And then let them sleep and gradually, make sure that they do okay. But everybody has to sleep. And, if you get knocked out, it's going to sleep is not going to make it worse. If you get knocked out, and you go to sleep, it's because of being, it's kind of the other way around. If you get knocked out and you go to sleep, then it's because of the injury. The actual going to sleep has nothing to do with it. How bad it's going to be or whatever. So, sleeping is fine. Just, be reasonable and keep a close eye on people.
See, now this all sounds extremely reasonable, but I did notice a bit of a controversy on your site over vaccines. Can you talk about just a bit about what happened there?
Well, some people hate vaccines. And so, yes, I have decided not to try to just stay out of that completely because I think that, some people you just can't talk into the vaccines or good in any way. They'll come up with something and you'll say, okay, well, the studies have not shown it. Well, they'll say, well, something else or the studies are wrong or somebody is trying to keep you down, from those studies. I say, if they don't want vaccines, okay, fine. I mean, I think as a public health, concern, if we all got vaccines, but there would be much, much less disease. If part of us got vaccines, they're not 100% effective. They do have side effects. And so, people even with vaccines are occasionally going to get sick, but they're going to decrease the risk of you getting the disease. There's less risk of, disease, of, problems and more, benefits in general. And then somebody will come up and say, yeah, well, say that to the person who had the severe reaction. Well, that's true. I can't and I certainly, have, much sympathy for those people, but, it's just like everything else. It's just like taking an herb or a natural product or whatever. If it is effective, in positive ways, there's always a possibility it'll be there'll be negative benefits and you might be one of those people that could have a really bad effect, side effect. Some vaccines are better than, more effective than others. Again, take your choice. I'm a proponent of vaccines, a proponent of people, having a choice on whether to get them also.
Well, and you will get no argument from anybody on this show about that. But some of your readers were definitely angry. But throughout your website, you've always been very upfront about how your advice is tailored to when there isn't medical attention available and that people should take preventative measures to avoid illness in the first place. And vaccines fall in line with that thinking. So why do you think your support of vaccination was surprising to some of your readers?
I think that some of the readers just look for those types of things. Some of them just are out there so anti-vaccine that they look for whatever I had accusations that I was trying to kill people and things like that. I mean, I don't think that's the majority of people. I think that the majority of people would either say, would either somewhat agree with me or at least not go that far and be violent. And when you start doing that, when you start saying things like that, I think you probably don't have a very good argument other than just, an accusation or something. I think that, prevention is definitely, better than treatment on everything. And these same people, would say, try to prevent by whatever, by healthy eating or whatever. I agree with that too. The vaccines are one way. I think one of the things is a lot of us around here in North America, we've gotten a little spoiled in that we don't get these diseases like some of the other countries. I mean, polio is virtually wiped out. But some of these other diseases are not in other countries and they could always come here and if you're not vaccinated, you're probably gonna be at least somewhat of an increased risk for most of the diseases. There's been some whooping cough here lately, and people who have had the vaccines have had it, and people who have not have had it. I hate to get into something trying to, make excuses or whatever for one side or the other, but way I understand it on whooping cough is the vaccine is a little different than used to. They've taken out some of the ingredients that some of the anti-vaccine people didn't like. And when they took that out, it just doesn't work as well. And it only works for sometimes a few years as opposed to longer than that. And so that's one of the reasons. I'm sure there are others, but there's that one situation versus multiple others where it helps.
Well, and one of the things that I was wondering is I definitely perused the comments on your site, and I think that some people might frequent your site, along with a number of other people, of course, but in order to avoid the medical industry altogether. And I think I got the sense that they felt like it was a betrayal of you to advocate for vaccines.
I think you're right there, too. I think I think if you look at anything I say on there, I'm a medical doctor, family practice, and I believe in conventional medicine. I believe in also looking at other sources. I try to get what has a little proof out there. A lot of the things that are non-conventional medicine don't have proof because they haven't been studied, so we don't really know. Other things have actually been shown not to work. And then again, people get mad if you say, okay, these things don't work, these other things do. Just because something is natural or whatever, even if it's a food, doesn't mean that it's better for you. It can. It definitely can, but not always. I think that if you don't know and you don't have such studies and things, and let me say about the studies and everything, that I know they're wrong at times. I just think from years, to years, we find that it wasn't quite the way we thought it was. Maybe something works or doesn't work or whatever. I think that if you're in doubt, you should think, is there anything out there, convention or not, that has been proven to work? If so, then I would not substitute something else for it. You might add it but I would also make sure that whatever you use is not harmful to you. I'd read up on it. I don't care what it is. Everything has a potential harm. If it has a potential good thing about it, it has a potential bad thing about it. And then I'll also worry about cost. If it's going to cost you a lot of money, I'd certainly look into it to make sure that there was a little proof behind it somewhere.
You're listening to Science for the People, and I'm joined by Dr. James Hubbard, survival medicine expert, about how to deal with medical problems during a disaster or whenever expert help is impossible to get.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell. My guest today is Dr. James Hubbard, survival medicine expert and the man behind thesurvivaldoctor.com. The comments on your website are fascinating. There seem to be a lot of young girls with fairly innocuous issues that read your blog. Have you noticed that?
I've noticed that a little bit lately. I think I have a variety of people. I think that some of the comments, are that I don't know what they're actually looking for. Maybe they're looking for some confirmation. I think some are. I think that, you know, sometimes I assume people, even with what I do, I still assume people know some things that don't know. And it's just like me and some other type of, some other type of field. I mean, a plumber probably assumes I know more than I do. And I probably assume people know some stuff. So there's that too. There's always, other than just pure science and pure facts in there. People have their own ways, their own situations, their own dynamics.
Comment section in the entire world.
Yeah.
It's interesting with these young girls. A lot of them will actually say that they don't want to talk to their parents about some topics. And I noticed that on the pinworm post, but also the post about yeast infections.
Yeah, the pinworm post is for, I think, males and females, and the yeast also. And that's, I think that's part of just growing up. They just don't understand that that's part of life. I mean, I have that coming. I've always had that in the office. People come in embarrassed, and I will say to them that, or I will think, I'll say something, but I'll also think, you're not going to come up with something that I haven't heard before, you know, and a lot of the things they're embarrassed about are things that everybody has or a lot of people have. And that's the case with some of these comments. They're not used to that. They're embarrassed. They're afraid that the family is going to get mad. And it's possible they do, but they need to, tell their parents and things about this. That's part of the things parents are for, to teach you about those things, to help you. In the case of like pinworms, they don't tell their parents, and their parents get those pinworms and don't know where they're coming from. And that's very likely in a family. I think they'd be a little more mad than somebody if the child comes up and say, hey, yeah, I know I've had them about 6 months, but I just didn't want to tell you, or something like that. I'm sure people get mad at them in situations, but I don't think the majority of parents are going to get mad. They've probably had that problem before in a lot of those situations, and they're more than welcome to help. But it's the same in coming to my office with adults. You know, I mean, people come in like it and they're embarrassed about things, and I can see their point, but, the other point is you can be embarrassed and suffer with the problem, or you can go ahead and tell it, or tell it to the right people and get it solved. And, who cares what the person thinks?
I'm just happy that these girls, even if they're, because let's face it, they might never tell their parents. They might just avoid it until it becomes something that's actually an emergency. So regardless, you treat these girls very respectfully in your website. And you answer their questions, which is fantastic.
I try to, and I never want to come between a healthcare provider and their patient, and I certainly never want to come between a parent or someone else and some child. So I try to, walk the line, sometimes I don't think they also understand that, I've never met them. I don't know anything about them. I haven't checked them. Whoever knows them I'm glad to give them advice, general advice, but, for their specific problem, they need to, have somebody that actually, is hands-on with them.
But it's interesting because again, just looking through the comments, you see these trends when you sort of read them all together like I did. So there's the young girls aspect, but there's also, there are a lot of commenters who just want advice as to whether whatever condition they have actually does require a doctor or not because they don't have insurance.
And I hope that I helped that with my, overall information. Certainly I think that's has always been a little bit of a problem. You don't want to go to a doctor and spend money when you can treat something at home. On the other hand, you don't want to miss things. And again, that's so individual. It's really hard for me. I can give them information and then they're going to have to decide for themselves, what to do, because it's such an individual thing. And I certainly don't want to be responsible for somebody not going to the doctor that should. Some of them have obvious problems and they say, okay, I cannot go to the doctor. What can I do? And I've got to tell them, look, although it may be expensive, it may be a lot of other things. It's not impossible to go to a doctor for a life-threatening or health-threatening problem at present. And that's what you need to do.
And you do that. You tell many, many people to give their butts to the doctor. I've noticed that, which is great. But it's interesting that on a survival medicine website, you have all of these different people with non-disaster related questions. I find that really interesting. But in addition, you do have people that are living in rural Haiti, I doing some kind of work out there, that are using your site to sort of diagnose and treat themselves because there literally is no way to get to the doctor. The nearest doctor is 200 miles away.
That's my favorite part on people like that. I've had some, missionaries who have been treating people and maybe have internet, but at times and they've gone to my ebooks on burns or something like that and have been able to been able to help them somewhat on people that just don't have any other alternative at all, things like that really keep me going.
I do have to mention that I was a bit disappointed that emergency tracheotomies weren't covered.
I thought about covering that. I mean, it's possible. I guess I'm like everybody else. I don't want somebody to do that and then blame me when they do it wrong. Or do it, say, oh, this person, needs a tracheotomy and they're still breathing. I mean, I've also had people tell me that they find somebody injured and they're talking to them and this person who's trying to help wants to do chest compressions on somebody talking to them. Or, if I've had people do the Heimlich, the abdominal thrust, which is just quite a life-saving thing, but they do it on people who weren't choking, So I don't want somebody going around and in a situation that they might have just been having a really, really bad cough or something like that. But I don't want them going around and saying, doing something and then saying, well, I got that from Dr. Hubbard. I hope that people who look at the site know, again, that this is for information only and only in the worst cases when nothing else is available.
You do, however, explain how to deal with a tension pneumothorax, which I had never even heard that term before.
Yeah. That was a little out of order, but I guess I'm taking a little chance there. But a pneumothorax is when air gets between the lung and the chest wall, the lung collapses. The typical one that you're going to see either is a leaking lung, lining has sprung a leak a little bit, or from trauma and there's a hole in the chest. There's trauma and there's a hole in the chest. That's called an open pneumothorax. You can actually, if you were out there on the highway or whatever, and you saw that, you could put a credit card or something or a driver's license on that. Perfect to use until help arrives because it becomes a one-way valve. Every time the person tries to breathe in, they don't suck in that air from the outside into their chest. Every time they breathe out, they're able to push any out that needs to come out. Tension pneumothorax is a little different. The reason I mention it in there is it's one of those life-threatening things that if it's not treated within, a certain amount of time, within sometimes, less than an hour, depending on the situation, it can kill you. And what that is that air gets trapped going the wrong way. So every time you breathe in, air comes in, and it can't get back out. So it's like a balloon blowing up inside your chest and pressing on your lung and pressing on your heart. Pretty soon the other lung gets to where it doesn't work and it presses on your heart so it doesn't work. So if you have a pneumothorax, you think you do for whatever reason. And I have on the website how you can look for that. One of the reasons, of course, would be if you had a hole in your chest. But if you have a pneumothorax and you've covered it, and the person just continues to get worse and worse, whereas they were short of breath and having pain and being fairly alert, all of a sudden they're not alert. They're getting more short of breath. Their pulse is going up, that sort of thing. Then you need to get that trapped air out if you can. Now, in order to do that, you're going to have a hollow needle. Now, a lot of people don't have that, but on my website, I actually have a little video course. That's one of the many things I show you how to do, and show you where you could get a needle if you wanted to. Show you how to put it in. It takes the air out. It doesn't do a thing for that open pneumothorax, so you still got one, but it's not the life-threatening pushing on your heart type anymore, and it can save a life. And certainly, emergency people, EMTs, paramedics, people who go out in ambulances and all that, they know how to do that. Probably most of them have done it, and most of them have saved a life because of it.
That is intense. Before we go, I do want to ask you a bit about duct tape 911, because I when you sent your biography, I realized that I had missed something very, very valuable, because that is right up my alley. Can you talk a bit about it?
I love to use medical household items for medical supplies. Medical supplies that can be used for more than one thing. I think that, you know, it's fantastic if you have these expensive medical supplies around, but you don't have to. If you don't have a tourniquet, you can use a belt. It's not as good and doesn't work as well, but I mean, we're talking about not having anything else. Same thing, you could use some duct tape. So I thought, there's so many things. Everybody knows about duct tape. Most people love duct tape, but I didn't see much out there on the medical uses that you can do with duct tape. So I wrote a book, illustrated. I think it's a fun read. I think it's a great gift for the holidays. And I've had a lot of people that have thought so also. And you learn something. So it's entertaining. People that have told me they can't put it down, but then you are also learning something. You're learning how to use a tourniquet, how to make duct tape from a tourniquet using duct tape, how to close a wound. Most people may already know, but how to treat a wart, get a wart off with duct tape. I've got about 20-something things in there, medical uses of duct tape. Certainly how to make a bandage over the chest, how to, you know, just all sorts of things.
I love this so much. It's not even funny. I will be contacting your publisher.
Great.
James, you are great. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We've linked to Dr. James Hubbard and thesurvivaldoctor.com on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. After the break, we're joined by Dr. Rob Tarswell to talk about what to do and not do when you're stranded in the wilderness. Stay tuned.
Science for the People is a weekly radio show exploring everyday life from a scientific perspective. To find out where Science for the People airs near you, or to listen to past episodes, check out our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. You'll also find links to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Google+, or to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Science for the People. I'm Desiree Schell, here with Dr. Rob Tarswell. And Rob is a clinical assistant professor on the Faculty of Medicine at the University of British Columbia and the man behind the YouTube video series 1 Minute Medical School. Welcome back, Dr. Rob.
Thanks for having me.
So just for people who have heard you on this show before, they might not know that you are not only a doctor, but you did some time in the Air Force.
That's right. It's my deep, dark secret. Well, it's not dark, nor is it secret. It just doesn't come up much. I was an anti-submarine warfare navigator in the 1990s.
And you are also a psychiatrist.
Right.
Now, that makes you perfectly suited to talk about what I want to talk about, which is how to survive in the outdoors if you don't particularly want to be there. Let's start with a scenario. So you're driving along a deserted road and your car breaks down because apparently today is not your day. So now what? Walk us through what what we should do?
I think that would depend on the time of year. So, I mean, of course, you being a prairie person these days know that once it's wintertime, you don't go anywhere without blanket, gloves, maybe some extra gas, some sand in the back of the car, things like that. But what are we talking about here?
Oh, well, let's go with that, since I do live in Alberta. So it's snowy. It's terribly snowy. It's horrible. Actually, today we're supposed to get, I'm not even joking, 20 to 30 centimeters. So everyone
well
else
deserved.
Who does not live in Alberta, feel free to pat yourselves on the back. But yes, so someone like me, the car runs out of gas in the middle of nowhere. What should
we do? Well, okay, so if the car's run out of gas, you're in big trouble. You probably only have maybe an hour or two before you're heading into hypothermia. So it's really important to figure out what you're going to do to conserve as much body heat as possible. That's probably going to involve staying in the car rather than walking away from it. There are lots and lots of people found dead in the middle of fields who think they can walk to safety. In the prairies especially, it's like the Las Vegas Strip. Everything's a lot farther away than it looks. That house you see, or that light you see out in the distance, that could be 5 kilometers away. And if you're in a ripping gale, forget it. You're not going to make it. Staying in the car, ideally you have a proper survival kit, but if you've run out of gas, you probably don't. So you're going to need to figure out how to stay warm. So that's bundling up whatever clothing you've got, getting into as compact a shape as you can, because the tighter in you are, the more like a sphere, your volume to surface area ratio goes up, so you radiate less heat. Because if you take, say, some silly putty and you stretch it out, that's going to radiate its heat a lot faster than if it's all packed into a little ball, even if it's the same mass or the same volume.
Well, under any circumstances, should you leave your car? Because what if you're there for 24 hours, you haven't seen any help coming? Is it a better idea to leave at that point or not, or just never?
Well, there's actually several good reasons to stay with the car. First of all, you probably haven't gone far off the road. So your best chance of somebody coming by is on that road that you've just gone off of. You can, if you see cars coming, because of course you're going to be watching, then you can very cautiously conserve your battery power by turning on the four-way flashers or the headlights to try and get someone's attention. So leaving the car, I think, would only make sense if you are absolutely certain where you are, the weather is not life-threatening, ha ha ha, and you know you can make it. Or you've got, if you've really sort of screwed everything up and you don't even have a cell phone, I think really you kind of need to stay in the car, because the people who are expecting you and the people who sent you are going to know you didn't show up where you were supposed to show up. Unless you're a complete loner who lives in the shack in the woods. But,
Let's go there. Okay, so you're a complete loner. You have no cell phone. And even if you had a cell phone, you have no friends. So you're stuck in the car. You've been there for, let's go back to 24 hours.
Yeah.
So how much food do you really need to survive? How long can you survive?
Well, interestingly, it's not so much the issue that you need calories, but after about 24 hours, you haven't been eating any carbohydrates or simple sugars, so your body switches energy systems. You go from carbohydrate burning primarily to fat burning. You go into a ketotic or ketone body producing state. And that is a good survival maneuver, but unfortunately, it's not as energetic or energized a state as when you have simple sugars available, like from carbohydrates. So if you need to change a tire or cut down a tree or go on a long walk, you're going to be in much bigger trouble trying to do that, because you're simply just going to be weak and tired.
So how long can one actually last without food?
Oh, gosh. Well, if you remember the IRA political prisoner strikes in the UK in the late 70s, you know, remember Bobby Sands, he lasted gosh, a good long time before passing away. What was it? Something like 77 days?
Okay, so you're not going to starve to death, probably, in your car.
Probably not going to starve to death in your car. No, the biggest enemy is going to be hypothermia.
Okay, well, let's switch the scenarios. It is a lovely time. It is, well, let's not say lovely. Let's say you're in the desert. Okay, now, there's, maybe you have some food, but you have no water.
That's a big problem. In the desert, you're probably looking at about 24 hours before you are dangerously dehydrated.
That's it. 24 yeah. hours.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Because when you're in the desert, you're going to be sweating significantly. So that could be, oh, gosh. Let's take an average 70-kilogram adult who's about two-thirds water. That's going to be, say, 50 liters of water. If you're out in the desert and you're perspiring between 2 and 4 liters a day, already by the end of day one, you have lost potentially between 5 and 10% of your total body water. That's a significant amount of water to lose. You're, 'cause the concentration of everything else in you is going up. And then you're getting into problems with your blood is starting to thicken. This is creating all kinds of problems with cellular action, and you just are in all kinds of trouble.
Well, now, what can you do to avoid that beyond, of course, having water with you? Is there any way that you can rehydrate yourself if you have no water?
Well, there are certain things you can do, like don't travel during the day. If you're going to try and travel in the desert, travel at night. During the day, do your best to find and stay in some kind of shade from the sun. Now, I mean, that's a little easier if you've magically got your car again. This time you don't want to be inside the car. You might want to be beside the car as long as you're out of the direct solar radiation.
So like under the car.
Well, sure. I suppose it depends on how bad the sandstorm is that got you off the road or whatever the heck it was that happened.
Now I have to ask, because of course I do, should one drink their own urine?
One should not drink their own urine because...
The mummies lie, Dr. Rob.
They have been known to do that. But if you think about what your kidney's job is, it is essentially to excrete your waste as efficiently as possible. And to do that, it concentrates it. So in a sense, the urine you're producing is the most concentrated water that you can produce from a solute point of view. So it's going to be always, unless you have some sort of strange disease like diabetes insipidus, which means your kidney can't concentrate and water is just going straight through you, in which case you've got bigger problems if you're out in the desert. Whatever you are voiding is going to be ultimately more concentrated than whatever's remaining inside of you. So if you drink that, all you are doing is elevating the concentration of solutes in your body.
Okay, so no drinking urine.
Don't drink your urine. And then ultimately what's going to happen, your kidney has a maximum concentrating capacity above which it can't go. We humans have really horribly inefficient kidneys that can concentrate approximately 2 to 2.5 times. And that's under a real challenge of the typical concentration of solutes in your blood. Whereas something like, you know, the Australian desert mouse is able to concentrate 500 to 1,000 times the amount of the concentration of solutes in its blood. We just kind of got the raw end of the deal when it came to kidney evolution.
So now what about the idea that one should suck on rocks or things of that sort? Does that work at all?
Well, it could be something like a comfort as a way of dealing with dry mouth. But you're not magically making water. All you're doing is making saliva, which you're then swallowing. So, I mean, there's certainly there's something to be said for not having a dry mouth among all the other horrendous discomforts you're facing, but no, you don't get any freebies.
Well, you mentioned comfort, so let's talk about the psychological angle here. Now, what are you experiencing when you're in this situation?
That really depends. There's quite a bit of interesting psychological research on the people who survive and the people who don't. Now, of course, it's one of these situations where the research is epidemiological in nature, because you can't ethically run experiments putting people out in the bush and saying, well, we might come back for you, we might not. But those who do tend to survive tend to be not necessarily those who are the halest and the hardiest, but it kind of boils down to the people who have a reason to live. So do you have young kids? Do you have somebody who you have some sort of obligation towards, somebody you're caring for? Do you have some kind of mission in life? But primarily the thing that keeps people going is young kids comes up a lot. Like, I had to survive for my children.
So have children if you want to survive.
If you absolutely must get lost in the wilderness under life-threatening circumstances, it's not a bad idea to have young, dependent children at home.
Oh, I don't know how much hope we're providing people with at this point. So that's, I'm wondering, now, you must have some pretty interesting survival stories, do you not?
Well, funny you should ask. It's not just by coincidence that we discovered today that I was in the Air Force. Part of my Air Force training was survival school, which included land survival, sea survival, and Arctic survival. And I was quite possibly, and this is going to undermine the confidence in everything I've just said, quite possibly the worst student who ever came through the Canadian Forces Survival Training School, or as it was called back then. When I was on land survival, on our last night, I decided, okay, I've been miserable, I've been cold, I'm going to build the biggest fire I can with all the wood that I've gathered. Well, I nearly set the forest on fire. In fact, I had got some roots burning, which is really dangerous. But the fire was so huge, I'm sure you could have melted pig iron with it. So I did achieve the goal of making a gigantic fire. But speaking of that ketotic state, I was moving in slow motion in this fire that you could have used to harden glaze on ceramic. And the only source of water was about 45 feet down a steep ledge, down to a little creek. And all I had to get water in were these old rusted Folgers coffee cans with holes in them. So there I am, slowly shambling up and down this bank, getting water from this creek, shambling back up, fighting this fire that was the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. It was just ridiculous. Yeah, really, right? So getting that thing out had nothing to do with my skill. It was pure luck. But as I learned, better lucky than good.
Rob, if you can't be a good example, you have an obligation to be a horrible warning. All right. Is there anything that you would like to leave people with before they go off on their various treks to see their family across desert and or snow?
Because that's what happens,
right.
In North America. My God, never let the gas tank get below half. Have sand in the back. Have candles. Have space blankets. Have food and water. The water might freeze, but you can drink it before it does that.
Would you tell them not to panic?
Well, that's a funny thing. Panic is one of these things you can tell people not to do, but it doesn't really seem to work. They just go ahead and panic anyway.
That's not reassuring in any sense whatsoever.
Yes. Don't panic, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, I'm sure that helped a lot. If anybody is listening to this on their car radio while they are stuck in their car, I am so sorry. Rob, as usual, I love you. You're great. Come back anytime.
All right. Well, all you have to do is extend the invitation.
And that was Dr. Rob Tarswell of 1 Minute Medical School. We've linked to him on our website at scienceforthepeople.ca. And, of course, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Google+, there are links for those, too. Or you can click the link for iTunes, where you can download past episodes or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Science for the People.